I want to welcome you to the Phoenix Bookstore. I am Jeannie Brittingham Erstead. I go by the name of She Who Remembers. I do audio tapes for KPFK. And I was thinking how I wanted to introduce Terrence. I took my name She Who Remembers because of my love of history and the ancient. And there was a wonderful book about the ancient Anasazi Indians called She Who Remembers. Well, in Terrence's tribe, he's got to be He Who Remembers. And I told my kids I was going to see a wonderful storyteller tonight. So I'd like you to all help me in welcoming Terrence McKenna. There are copies of Archaic Revivals here also.
Okay.
We'll wake up the world.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. If this is Friday, this must be Santa Monica. It's sort of been that kind of a week. I'm humbled and amazed to see so many people turned out for this. And basically, I'm here to promote a new book of mine called Food of the Gods. From Bantam, and I understand that there are also here tonight copies of the Archaic Revival, which is technically not released yet, so you can be well ahead of the curve if you get a copy of that, because I don't think it will be generally released for about 3 weeks. So let me just say a little bit about this book that I've been working on for a couple of years, and then we can talk about it for a half hour or so, and then I'll sign copies for the hardcore, so to speak. What I wanted to do with this book, The Food of the Gods, was I wanted to set down in as careful and as well-documented a fashion as possible the argument for looking again at the impact of psychedelic plants on human evolution, on the emergence of all of the higher qualities that we associate with our own unique species out of simple animal organization. And I wanted to do this not because I wanted to carry out some kind of academic criticism of the orthodox theory of evolution, although that was part of my intent, but really because I felt that if we could change the way we think about how psychedelics were used in the past, it would change the way we think about these things in our present situation. Many of you probably lived through a portion of the 1960s psychedelic revolution, and there psychedelic plants and experiences and drugs were presented sort of as instantaneous psychotherapy. There was not, in the 1960s, the awareness that these were not something new, these experiences and compounds, but really what was being discovered was the world's oldest religion as it was practiced during the first million years, before it was taken over by beady-eyed little priests with their shopping lists of moral commandments and prescriptions. Basically, you see, there is a great mystery about human emergence out of animal organization. The orthodox theory of evolution works very well for explaining how higher plants emerged out of simpler plant forms, how higher animals emerged from lower forms. But the great unsolved mystery of evolution generally
is located in our own peculiar story, because in less than a couple of million years, the human brain size doubled during the last 3 million years. This has been called the most explosive development of the organ of a higher animal in the entire evolutionary record. And so then the question becomes, you know, what was the cause? What was the detonator? What was the catalyst which literally revealed the presence of the human soul floating on a platform of primate organization? And the case that I have made is, I think, very simple, very easy to understand, and has deep implications for how we live our own lives today and how we organize our societies today. It's a very simple three-step process. As the climaxed tropical rainforests of the cradle of humanity began to recede a million or so years ago in Africa, which is the cradle of the human race, our remote fruit-eating ancestors, who were perfectly happy having achieved a kind of evolutionary equilibrium in the canopies of these tropical rainforests, were forced down onto the grasslands in a situation of great evolutionary pressure. They were having to learn new forms of locomotion, bipedalism, a new way of coordinating the visual system, binocular vision, and most importantly, they were coming under dietary pressure. And one of the points that I make in my book very strongly is that orthodox thinking about evolution has never admitted the importance of diet into thinking about evolution. We all know that evolution proceeds through random mutation, which then meets a force called natural selection. But usually, random mutation is presented as something which is to be traced back to cosmic rays and radiation present in the environment. Certainly, this is one of the inputs into the process of mutation. But you see, when an animal or a human being suddenly expands their diet, suddenly begins to eat foods and experiment with foods that they have never experimented with before, these foods, these plants, contain all kinds of exotic chemicals. Natural insecticides, agents that cause these plants to taste very bitter so that animals will reject them as food. And these chemicals are mutagenic agents. So diet, a sudden shift in diet, exposes a population to many more mutagenic influences than it was facing previously. This happened to our proto-ancestors. And as they began testing new foods in the grassland environment of the African veldt, they came upon psilocybin-containing mushrooms, which were growing in the dung of wild forms of cattle, which were also evolving in this new grassland environment. Well, now the key, or one of the pivotal concepts in my notion, is related to the fact that psilocybin actually, in very low doses, increases visual acuity, edge detection, and a kind of visual clarity is an affect of very low doses of psilocybin, the equivalent, in fact, of having a plant in the environment which confers chemical binoculars on its user. Well, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to see that if there's a plant which gives better vision and there's a hunting and gathering animal in the proximity of that plant, that the animals that admit that plant into their diet will be more successful hunters, more successful gatherers. They will obtain an expanded food supply for their offspring, and they will tend to outbreed the non-psilocybin-using members of the population. Now, at slightly higher doses, psilocybin, like all CNS stimulants, causes what pharmacologists and medical people call arousal. This simply means a kind of undirected restlessness, a state of high alertness, restlessness, pacing, and in a highly sexed species like ourselves, it means erection in the male and subsequent sexual activity. This is a second factor, then, which would promote the outbreeding of the non-psilocybin-using members of the population, you see, because the psilocybin-using members of the population have an expanded food supply, more sex, more offspring. Naturally, they will tend to push out other members of the group. Well, then finally, at the psychedelic dose level of these mushrooms, you get a very important quality. In fact, the centrally important quality for my argument, which any of you who have ever taken these things have experienced yourselves, and that's what I call boundary dissolution. And here's the notion in a nutshell. When you look back through the primate phylogeny, clear back to the primitive primates, the squirrel monkeys and those sorts of animals, there are always what are called male dominance hierarchies. There's an alpha male animal who, through brute force usually, takes the most desirable females under his command and sets his lieutenants over his male lieutenants over the rest of the females. And this is how these monkey societies order themselves. Well, because psilocybin is a boundary-dissolving hallucinogen, and because the essence of ego consciousness, which is necessary for these boundary hierarchies, for these dominance hierarchies, the essence of ego is boundary definition. So what I'm actually suggesting in this book is that we self-medicated ourselves into a state of gender equality and partnership, consciously or unconsciously, by allowing this item in our diet which suppresses ego and hence suppressed male dominance hierarchies. And so the ordinary momentum of primate evolution was interrupted. And for a period of about, who knows, pick a number, somewhere between 15 and 50,000 years, ending about 10,000 years ago, we actually lived in a kind of paradise where human beings were at equilibrium and in balance with the earth, where men and women were in balance with each other. And I should have mentioned this sexual arousal, which went along with the mushroom taking, promoted a style of orgy, probably at festivals which were lunar, at the new and full moon. Everybody basically just jumped each other's bones in a big heap. And the social consequence of orgy as a social style is that it makes it impossible for men to trace lines of male paternity. This is very important. There is, in a society which practices orgy, no concept for men of my children. There is only the concept of our children, meaning the tribe, the group. So male loyalty goes toward the group. And this is very important, because once men discovered male paternity, they discovered ownership of hunting grounds, food supplies, women, you name it. And it tended to feed back into the formation of the ego structure. Well, and so I believe that really that was the golden age of humanity that we all long for and have a great poignancy for, that has even been called the nostalgia for paradise. I believe we have this nostalgia for paradise because we are the victims of a fall. You see, what happened was this African grassland environment, which was necessary for the ecology of the mushrooms and therefore necessary to maintain this partnership paradise, eventually it all dried up. The Sahara turned to desert. These people were forced out of Africa into the ancient Middle East, and we fell into history. And this is the moment at which agriculture was invented. Agriculture, because you have to stay in one place and tend the crops and defend the surplus of these successful agricultural efforts, means the end to nomadism. It means the birth of cities. It means the creation through surpluses of classes of those who have and those who have not. It promotes kingship. It creates the need for standing armies. You can tell the drift here. All the institutions that we associate with male oppression, with hierarchy, with dominance, come into play at that point. So I don't want to spend too much time on this, but just in a nutshell, that situation is the situation in which we were born and came to consciousness, the paradisical situation of gender partnership that then dissolved. It was really a return back to the earlier primate style of male dominance and hierarchy when the mushroom was no longer available. We returned to our old monkey ways, and we have been practicing those monkey ways ever since, even as we reach toward the sequencing of the human genome, the exploration of the solar system, the exploration of the heart of matter. Nevertheless, we do it from a psychologically damaged perspective. Now, the question of drugs. Why, as a species, are we so obsessed and so addictable to so many things? There are a few animals who will break into a compound for fermented fruit or something like that, but we addict to dozens of substances and behaviors. Well, I believe that you can make an analogy to a person who was abused or traumatized as a child. The entirety of human history has been acted out in the light of the traumatic severing of our connection into the Gaian mother goddess planetary matrix of organic wholeness that was the centerpiece of the psychedelic experience back in the high Paleolithic. In other words, the world of hallucination and vision that psilocybin carries you into is not your private unconscious or the architecture of your neural programming, but it is in fact a kind of entelechy, a kind of being, a kind of Gaian mind. For Paleolithic human beings, it was the great goddess. Once you sever from this matrix of meaning, what James Joyce called the mama matrix, most mysterious, once you sever yourself from that, then you have nothing but rationalism, ego, and male dominance to guide you. And that's what has led us into the nightmarish labyrinth of technical civilization, overpopulation, classism, racism, sexism, propaganda, so forth and so on. All the ills of modernity. So I wrote this book making this argument because I believe that if we could import into straight society, almost as a Trojan horse, the idea that these psychedelic compounds and plants are not aberrational, they are not pathological, they are not some minor subset of the human possibility that only freaks and weirdos become involved with, but rather they are in fact the catalyst that called forth humanness out of animal nature. If we could entertain this as a possibility, it would change the way we think about so-called primitive societies, shamanism, the psychedelic experience, society's efforts to control and eradicate these substances. And I believe that we are really in a race on this planet now between education and disaster. And it is the momentum of the ego that threatens to shove us over the cliff into Armageddon. Famine, overpopulation, you can kiss goodbye to democratic values. We are all going to live in an Orwellian anthill if we don't, what? Change our minds. We have to change our minds on a dime. I'm not talking about a 500-year program to slowly straighten things out. We have, I believe, less than 30 years to come to terms with the dissolving ozone hole, the toxification of the oceans, the greenhouse effect, the spread of epidemic disease, the rise of fascism, the relentless efforts of the free marketeers to deal products in every corner of the planet. We must change our minds. And what we have to do is have recourse to these same shamanic plants and shamanic practices that allowed our remote ancestors to come to terms with the mystery of being and their situation on this planet vis-a-vis the rest of nature. So I think it's very important at this time to make this argument as clearly as possible, to launch the idea into society, and let argument and debate rage. Now, you may think that I'm proposing blowing up some already existing edifice of theory about how human beings came to be. This is not the case. As a matter of fact, orthodox anthropology hasn't a clue. We are the fly in the soup of natural sciences' explanation of the evolution of species. It's easy to understand how one kind of hummingbird emerges from another. It's not very easy to understand how creatures that build something like Los Angeles can emerge out of creatures who hunt ants by sticking grass stems down their holes, you know. We represent some kind of primary break with nature at the animal level. And I believe it's because we have a symbiotic relationship
with all of nature. We are wired for this. There are drug receptors in our brains, in our physical brains, that have been carried along for 1,000 generations without really being called into use. But now is the time. If we really believe that these things expand consciousness, then we must study them, use them, apply them, because it's the absence of consciousness that is creating a terminal crisis, not only for us as a species, but for every living thing on this planet. And I think the psychedelic experience is as much a part of being alive as sexuality, language, the things which fulfill us and give meaning to the human experience are left incomplete and impossible to assimilate if we don't place the capstone on the edifice of our being in the world. And the capstone on that edifice is our right, our obligation, and the privilege of dissolving our ordinary ego boundaries and merging with the mind and purpose of the planet. And this is what I was trying to say in the book, and this is what I hope I'm able to communicate to you this evening. Thank you very much.
Okay, the first one. If you were in jail 20 years ago and you had to choose between Finnegan's Wake and McLuhan books or any drug, which would you choose? How about today?
Has something happened in 20 years that should make these different choices? Well, I think I would choose, I'm in prison, right?
Yeah. You can either read or get high.
In spite of the flash of something like silver,